Now, on Documentary on News Talk, producer Sarika Herron explores the history of Ballykinler internment camp in County Down, where thousands of Irishmen, including her own grandfather, were interned by the British Army during Ireland's War of Independence. In Ballykinler, the Barbed Wire Cage.
I'm here at Kilmainham Jail with my dad and Auntie Moira to make a donation.
Do you mind these steps? And then I'll get this door to you as you come in.
We're meeting Aoife Torpey, assistant curator at the museum.
The donation forms here, there's always boring paperwork associated with these things, but I'll fill it out and then I'll show you where you need to put in some details and sign some things. And just to let you know, these items will become part of the Kilmainham Jail Museum collection, which is held in trust for the Irish people.
Okay, thank you.
That's wonderful, thank you.
To really explain why we're here, and what we're donating, I need to bring you back to Ireland's War of Independence, and more specifically, the role my granddad, or my papa as I call him, played in it.
He was a runner, I know, in 1916, bringing messages from here to there. And he went down to the post office at the time, and wanted to get into the post office. O'Reilly told him to go home and mind his mother, but if we need you for to bring any messages, we'll use you.
I never really knew my papa. He died soon after I was born. But growing up, there were occasional tales of his and my nana's passion for republicanism.
These were his membership cards of the National Association of the old IRA. He did some full training with and without arms. He did some intelligence work. There was an anti-conscription activities. The general election of 1918, he was involved in that.
But it wasn't until more recent years that I took a keener interest. In 2016, as the decade for centenaries was in full swing, I came across a very old black and white photo, tucked between the pages of a delicate little book of notes and drawings, an autograph book, and I was curious to know more. Here is my dad, Murrish.
This is the autograph book.
So that's the photo.
They're the
original
photos, yeah.
Okay, let me see that one. I'll handle it carefully, don't worry. Oh, wow.
There are a motley crew in various clothes, obviously very pretty tattered.
They all look pretty young, except for one guy.
Yeah, in the centre is my grandfather, Joseph Hearn, and he has his hand on the shoulder of a gentleman in the front, who's my father, James Hearn. I mean, you can see the quality of it is pretty poor.
Yeah, and what's on the back of it? Can you make it out?
Member of Hut 14, number 2, Camp Ballykinler, 1921.
I mean, how old was Grandad then in 1921?
Well, then, let me see, 1921, my father was 21. He was 48.
My great-grandfather.
Your great-grandfather.
Did you know what the photograph was?
We always knew that it was during his time in Ballykinler.
Did you ever talk to him about it?
No, unfortunately, like a lot of people, you just never got around to these things. They were always in the background in a very informal way. So you never sort of said, oh gosh, I must talk to my father about that photograph. It was just there.
I'd never even heard of Ballykinler. Where was it? Was it a prison? Was it a military camp? How did my grandfather and my great-grandfather end up there? I decided to start digging and discovered that Ballykinler was located in the north in County Down. Today, it's a British Army training centre. But what role did it have in Ireland's War of Independence? My initial search threw up a couple of names. Pat McCarthy of the Military History Society of Ireland seemed like a good place to start.
Ballykinler was established as an army training camp around about 1900. So they picked this remote spot in County Down And they set up a small camp there in 1900 and began to train members of the Royal Irish Rifles, the local regiment, in musketry there. But in 1914, with the outbreak of the First World War, it was expanded massively, as it was used to train a brigade. Now, a brigade would be about 5,000 soldiers. So they built the huts, built new training ranges, bought hundreds of more acres where it could be used for training. And then, early in December 1920, internment had been on the books, but had not been used since 1916.
So, it turns out that by the time the War of Independence came about, Ballykinler was being earmarked by the British authorities as an internment camp. Professor of Irish Contemporary History, Eunan O'Halpin, gave me a little bit more information.
In terms of the War of Independence, I think the decisive point is when the Restoration of Order in Ireland Act is passed in August 1920. The Government of Ireland Act was a done deal. They were committed to establishing a sixth county in Northern Ireland, and it was a matter of getting the Republicans, if you like, as they saw, to see sense and compromise. And in the meantime, they introduced powers of detention, much more extensive and much easier to use under this Act than the powers they had previously operated under. This, I think, was very important in terms of thwarting the Republican campaign, because it meant that the authorities could simply arrest people and intern them indefinitely on suspicion. By November 1920, there had been a decision at IRA headquarters to step up the pressure on Britain, particularly in Dublin, where it was felt that the British were getting the upper hand in terms of gathering information on the IRA. And a decision was taken to eliminate as many supposed British agents as possible. And that's the genesis of what becomes known as Bloody Sunday. In the afternoon, when Crown forces came into Croke Park, where there was a fundraising match on for prisoners' dependents, they opened fire without warning. The consequence of that was over a dozen people died at the scene or immediately afterwards. And these are civilians. There was no suggestion that they actually were carrying weapons or anything. So on both sides, you had a very definite upping of the stakes. And also on the British side, a demonstration of an utter lack of discipline.
Bloody Sunday sent shockwaves throughout the country, and the British were now intent on rounding up as many people as possible, absolutely anyone who had any link to the Republican movement. Professor O'Halpin suggested I contact Liam O'Diver. He's author of Prisoners of War, Ballykinler, and he told me just how far the British were prepared to go.
Bloody Sunday 1920 was obviously the catalyst or the knee-jerk reaction that they went en masse and arrested men from all over the 32 counties. Anyone who was suspected of being involved, Sinn Féin, the GAA, or the IRA, it didn't matter. It was anyone who was suspected of being involved, and that even people involved in Irish culture, the Irish language, anyone. It was just a widespread just arrest, and they weren't really concerned with anyone having evidence against anyone. It was based on probably members of the community would be pointing them out to be friendly with police, friendly with military, and say these individuals are involved in these organisations and should be arrested.
Is this what happened in the case of my family? I know my papa was active during the War of Independence, but how did my great-grandfather end up getting arrested? Here's what my dad knows.
Well, the circumstances, again, going from information that was always in the family given to us by my father, that a member of the DMP, that's the Dublin Metropolitan Police, and a soldier came to their home at 30 Wellington Street, and they knocked obviously on the door. My grandmother answered, and they asked her, is there a J. Heron here?
But my Auntie Moira tells it slightly differently.
They didn't do that. They burst open the door. They didn't. My father told me that. My aunts told me that. That they burst in the door. I remember Auntie Molly telling me that. That she was terrified. She didn't know. They were either at their tea or something. They were at a meal anyhow. They were sitting down to a meal. and the lorry was outside. You see, they'd be out at the windows listening to houses to hear any conversations, and they searched the house. They came in, raided the house, and picked my father up to arrest him because he was a member of the IRA at the time. And his father, who was not politically minded in any way, shape or form, he was arrested because he had the same initial. And that was Christmas week.
Dublin Metropolitan Police!
Which one of you is Jay Heron?
What? Which one?
I'm James Heron.
And I'm Joseph Heron.
Right, take them both.
No!
It'll be alright, Mary.
Take them both.
I'll get back soon.
It's okay, Ma. Don't cry.
Get up. Get out there.
Molly,
be good for Ma.
Come on, get along.
So they took both of them away just to make sure, I'm sure, that they got the right person.
Must have been very hard for when you're seeing your husband and your eldest son going out the door and put into a truck.
Okay, well, we'll look up findmypast.ie. So that's the family folklore. But surely there had to be a more official account of what happened. My dad and I reckoned there had to be something more online. Okay, so then this is James Heron, the year 1920, Easter Rising and Ireland under martial law, 1916 to 1921.
Right.
And the address is 30 Wellington Street, Ireland.
Okay.
So I click here and this has the image. I wonder what it is. Okay, so it says secret, pro form A.
And it's unusual to see the top of the document secret. So I just wonder when that was released.
Raid carried out on the 7th of the 12th, 1920. One officer, i.e. party, Lieutenant J.P. Arnott.
Oh my goodness.
That's mental.
Isn't it?
That you
that I should work for Arnott, but I don't think there's a connection. I would doubt it. But
hopefully
anyway,
not.
Oh well, sure.
Anyway, full circle.
I'm not too worried. I have my pension.
Full name of all persons in the house: J.O.S. Joseph, James, Eileen, Molly. So that was the Mary,
yeah.
And Mrs. Mary Heron. Instructions issued: search for arms, etc., and arrest J. Heron. So that's
all right.
Your
yeah.
Story. Arrests affected two, J.O.S. Joss Heron, labourer,
right,
which
is said, yeah.
And then J.A.S. James Heron, salesman.
Okay.
Evidence found in detail, criminal arms, so nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they kept them.
Yeah.
That's so annoying.
That's fantastic. That's really fantastic to see.
But just like that, like kind of real...
Well, it brings it to life. It really brings it to life, what we had been told and knew within the family.
It seems it was just a cruel twist of fate that saw both father and son being arrested. But Ballykenler is in County Down. That's a long way away from Dublin.
This was now a war. They decided to use internment. So they fenced off part of the camp with the idea of it housing 1,000 internees. Within 2 weeks, that was full. So they had to wire off another part of the camp for another 1,000 internees. Now, a feature of Ballykinder, given its location, was that you were picked up, there you were screened. If you could be charged, we say, with armed offences or taking part in an ambush, you would be charged. You could be released. Or you could be simply decided, we'll lock him up, we'll intern him. If they decided to intern you, when they had enough, they'd put you on board a British destroyer, the Waterhen, and bring you by sea up to Belfast. You would be landed at the docks in Belfast, which were very, very orange, very Protestant. And as you were being marched through the docks, you were inevitably showered with what they call Belfast confetti, which would be rivets, iron rivets, you know, very substantial bolts, nails and so on like that. And some of them were quite seriously injured.
My father got a belt of stone in his eye. And that's how he lost the sight of his eye. And he had several operations afterwards. It must have been very hard for them.
Aoife Torpey tells me that that journey was only the beginning for so many men right across the country.
So the internees in Ballykinler were from all over the country, all 32 counties. Some had even been brought over from England and from Scotland. But they were ordinary men. Some were members of the IRA. Some were members of Sinn Féin. Others had no connection, were sometimes arrested by accident or were arrested just on suspicion of having been involved. So you get a range of men. You get farmers, clerks, university lecturers, doctors, artists. They're a really broad spectrum of society and they're from all over the place. And they're meeting each other in Ballykinler, often for the first time. And some of them get on, some of them don't get on. You get county rivalries, but they make friends in the camp with people they may never have met otherwise. But they can't forget that they're locked up in Ballykinler at all.
What the British hadn't envisaged, what they had actually done in Ballykinler is established a community. Because the people who were there, you would have found in any town in Ireland, you had everything from a school teacher to the electrician, the plumber, the doctor, the tailor, you know, they were all there. So they had actually, within the two compounds of the internment camp, they had basically presented them this two communities in Ireland, all male though, but it was a fascinating thing.
In amongst my papa and great-grandfather, two ordinary Dublin men, were more prominent players in the Republican movement. There were people such as Sean Lamass, Patter Carney, Martin Walton. But how did the British authority view all these men? Were they considered outright criminals, or were they given any special status?
There would be no official recognition of the prisoner of war status. Okay? That's the first thing. There was no official recognition of it. They could not claim to be prisoners of war. They saw themselves as prisoners of war. But as in a lot of these things, the British Army saw themselves, their job was to keep them inside the wire. They didn't really care about what went on inside the wire. So as soon as the first internees arrived, they established a pseudo-military structure. They had their commanding officer. Each hut had a commanding officer. It had a second in command. The commanding officers from the huts formed the camp council and they elected the camp commandant and the camp vice commandant. So they established a structure. They established parades and so on like that. And by and large, the British Army let them at it. Once they were inside the wire, as far as the British Army was concerned, they were doing their job. They had them locked up and they were keeping them there. So they would have seen themselves as prisoners of war. But officially, such status did not exist.
Despite the laissez-faire attitude to their prisoner status, life in the camp could not have been easy.
The camp itself was quite a large one. There were two internee camps, Camp 1 and 2, and the internees called them the cages. So they were surrounded by barbed wire. There were sentry boxes watching them. Those sentries were armed, so they always were aware that there was a man with a rifle looking at them. But the camp itself was built on sand. It was quite damp. It seems to have been really windy. The wind came howling down from the moorings and off the sea. And it was cold. And a lot of the internees complain about the huts they were living in because they were wooden. They were drafty. And they were freezing cold because they didn't have very much clothing. They had whatever clothes they came up with. Occasionally they were given clothing to wear by the British military. But they also were sleeping on wooden trestle boards instead of beds. They had thin mattresses stuffed with straw, and then blankets, they were always complaining, were more like fishing nets than blankets. So it seems to have been a very dark, damp, dank place. And that the conditions and the weather particularly occupies the internees' thoughts an awful lot. We also do have a more personal item in the collection, and these are letters written by a man called Peter Byrne, who was a Dublin man from Barrow Street in Ringsend. And we have dozens of letters he wrote from Ballykinler to his wife Frances. So he was arrested in late November 1920, and he sends these letters to Frances several times a week, and they're beautiful.
My dearest Frances, your welcome letter's received. I got 3 during the week, and you know how glad I do be to get all news from home. I'm hoping and praying to be home soon.
He loved her very, very much. He signs all of them as your dear and loving husband, your fond and affectionate husband. He refers to her as aunt and himself as uncle, because they had recently become auntie and uncle to his brother Joseph's son Brendan, and they're very proud. And these letters give us an insight into Francis and Peter's relationship, but also Peter tells us the realities of life in internment.
Oh, I'm in a barbed wire cage, and I never see the outside world, and it is a hell of a place. I'd far sooner be in jail than in this place. We always have trouble here, and there's never any peace, night nor day. Oh, a fellow would be better in his grave than living in this hole.
He talks about arguments they have with fellow internees. He falls out with his brother Joe, who was also interned at one point, and sends a long letter to Francis, basically saying, we're not talking to Joe anymore, at all.
Oh, I am sorry to say, I get a lot of trouble from him. Oh, he's tried his high bullying talk, so as I cannot stick him any longer. I will not take anything that is sent to him. I can do splendid with what you send me. When I get home, there will be big changes.
I wonder what my own family were going through. How did my great-grandmother cope with both her eldest son and her husband gone?
To think like that at that time, my grandmother, the rest of the family were all younger. They were young kids. And she was left with nothing. There was no provision made for them. That was terrible because they were the two breadwinners of the house. They were taken out. So I don't know how she existed at all. But it must have been very, very hard for her because his sisters were very young, were only at school. And I think, when I think about it now, you know, that my father was only, I don't know whether he was an apprentice or what, and he was working, and he was the eldest, you know, devastating.
The wives, the mothers, bore the brunt. An 18-year-old was hit a number of times, and he was taken into the hospital in Ballykinlar camp and died there just about a month after he'd been arrested and brought there. Now, his mother requested that the body be sent home to Tallow, which it was, and after she had buried her eldest son and she was a widow, the British Army sent her a bill for £34, a huge amount of money in those days, when the weekly wage would be less than £2, for the cost of conveying the son to Tallow. I hope she never paid it.
I know that life on the outside for my family was tough. But what about my papa and great-grandfather on the inside? What was life like in the camp? What did they do every day? What did they eat? Did they ever try to escape? How long were they in there for? What went on inside that barbed wire cage?
You are listening to Ballykinlar, The Barbed Wire Cage, on documentary on News Talk.
Life in Ballykinlar was boring. Boring, boring, boring.
The day would have started with the reveille, which was basically a waking signal, and that was usually around 7:15 in the morning, and then they would have been out of bed by 7:30. Washing at 8 a.m. followed by breakfast, which is bread, butter and tea, and then they also had to attend their roll call each morning.
They had some sort of education policy going. A lot of it is learning Irish, but there's also people teaching geography, geology, drama, anything you might bring to the table, you can teach. They also have a library. They do physical classes. They learn boxing, Irish dancing, again. Very important to do Irish things.
dinner was at 1 p.m. and the tea was at 4:30 p.m. But in between all that, there was various activities the men were encouraged to get involved in.
They're learning all sorts of things, and they get certificates as well for completing these courses. It's not just a waste of time. You get a certificate, and it is just something to do, occupy the men during the very busy days, but also a way to improve yourself for Ireland.
It didn't matter if it was playing cards or it was taking part in a sport, arts and crafts. You didn't have to get involved in any educational activities, but as long as they were doing something to pass the time, there were men who were just happy to spend the time sitting about smoking.
So we actually have James Heron here taking part in some of the classes. Now, unfortunately, I cannot figure out what these classes are. Whoever has written them in shorthand. But you can see James Heron, he had no attendance in one particular class, but he was attending in another class. So obviously one of them took his interest, the other one didn't. So I know they're doing Irish language.
This would tally with stories of my papa's graw for the Irish language. However, my Auntie Moira has something that shows he also took on some more artistic endeavours.
There it is.
Oh, look.
See?
And that's out of bone.
Out of a bone, yeah.
So it's like a little harp.
Yeah.
You can see all the outline on it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. For something to do.
Pass the time.
Pass the time away.
So they make harps from the scapula or the shoulder bone of a cow because the shape lends itself very nicely to creating a harp. And they would have spent a long time carving these and making souvenirs. So it's not just a souvenir of their time imprisonment, but it's also a deliberate memorialization of what happened to them. They are very aware that in being interned or imprisoned, they are part of a political movement. And they're very conscious that this is something that is making history. So making something occupies the time, but it also means when they leave, they'll have an object that says, I was in Ballykinder, I served my time.
Dad said that Papa had maybe carved it for Nan.
Yeah, probably did, yeah. And she was in the Fairview branch of Cumann na Mban. I know where they met. They met at a Cayley. And like it was like a party. And somebody be asked to sing. And my mother sang Ireland, Mother Ireland. And my father said, that's how he fell in love with her.
Ireland, Mother Ireland, let what may befall, ever shall we hold you, dearest, best of all.
My dearest Francis, now, I want you to go to Arnott's, Pym's, or the other big houses and get a ball of macrame cord. Mind the name, macrame cord, and send it to me as soon as you can by return of post.
So there was a macrame mania in Ballykinder. Macrame is a form of almost like crochet, and you can make bags and mantles and all sorts from it. And it obviously, one man knew how to make macrame and he taught everybody else. And they were going crazy for it. They would get yarn sent up and they would make little bags for loved ones to send home as a souvenir. But it was also another way to occupy the time.
Like any prisoner of war camp, exercise, classes, chess, reading, and they also tried every possible means of escaping. Now they had one disadvantage in Ballykinder. It's essentially built on a whole series of sand dunes, and digging a tunnel through sand is quite difficult because it keeps collapsing. But they got very near to success a number of times.
There were numerous tunnels within the camp, and one, the biggest tunnel, was near completion and was only a couple of hundred yards from the outskirts of the camp. The entire tunnel structure was shored by wood and had candles. It had rails for a cart to go down and pile the dirt in and bring it up to the surface. And that was basically spread in the handball court and spread by other means just to get it out. Similar to if you think of the film The Great Escape. the British were fascinated by it. The British engineers were brought in and actually brought in to investigate it and to take notes. So Ballykinner tunnels were possibly used as a blueprint for the British in their escape attempts later on during the Second World War.
And as much as the internees tried to smuggle themselves out, they also did their best to smuggle things in, to help create not one, but two newsletters.
In Camp 1, it was called Nor Bocklesh, which is don't let it bother you or don't mind it. And in Camp 2, it was called the Barbed Wire. And the internees created this themselves with goods that were smuggled in. So in Camp 1, they had a typewriter and a duplicating machine. In Camp 2, they had to copy it all by hand. So they it took them a lot longer to produce the barbed wire. But these newsletters give fantastic details on what the internees' thought life was like. There's editorials on individual internees who they respected. There are reports on the drama societies, productions, the orchestra.
Wanted, principal boy and other well-shaped ladies for panto. Send waist measurements to the office. Bring on tights.
They report on the handball and football matches they were hosting in the camp.
Handball is all the rage just now. The crack of the rubber within the wires has almost drowned that of the rifle. We have noticed that the game is especially popular among those whose avoir de poids does not allow them to take much part in football.
And they're also full of hilarious puns.
Tonalitis has been diagnosed as restlessness, insomnia, continual scratching and digging with high temperature. There is an inclination to violence, and the symptoms are generally accompanied by perspiration.
While the men in Ballykinner busied their days trying to counteract boredom by bettering themselves, some men were not so fortunate.
There were a number of deaths in the camp. There were several in relation to ill treatment and neglect. There was a number of more deliberate deaths of Joseph Tormey and Patrick Sloan. Both men were from County Westmeath. And what happened was an individual who had been interned and brought into number 2 compound who was considered suspicious was brought before or close to the wire. There was a blind spot where the sentries couldn't see a certain section, and he was brought over to be identified by another individual from his area to basically verify whether he was genuine and legitimate. And as they walked away, the sentry just shot them. One bullet killed both men, and it was a pretty harrowing scene.
Halt! Halt!
Just about midday on that Monday, I was in my hut when I heard a shot ring out. I paid no attention to it at first, for shots from sentries were beginning to get common. Then I saw somebody running and the news came along the line that 2 men were killed. When I got up beside Hut 11, I found that practically the whole camp had gathered. And then, men were on their knees saying the rosary.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with
you. It was a moment of terrible excitement and deep emotion. And the sight of our 2 comrades lying in their blood was something calculated, to sweep off their feet even the calmest of men. It was clear from their position that they had not been standing near the wires.
At the time, you had the Defence of the Realm Act, so no inquest was ever held. It was more of a military tribunal, which wouldn't have had the same kind of in-depth inquiry into the deaths, and the British would have controlled it, and it was their inquiry at the end of the day. It wasn't a public independent inquiry into anyone's death, and may not have been very interested in holding anyone to account, especially a British soldier.
Most soldiers on sentry duty are about 17 or 18. They're just in the army. The thing they are most scared of is the corporal and the sergeant. They're actually poorly trained. They have a gun, they have ammunition, they have standing instructions, and their instructions are to give 2 warnings and then to fire. And they don't know what will happen to them if they ignore those warnings. And there seems to be the case that the 2 fellows who were shot, I think, were by a single round. He either lost his nerve or didn't use his judgment, and he just went, halt, halt, bang. And he probably never had seen somebody shot before.
Dearest Francis, we may be home for Christmas, but of course we cannot say. We might be here for another year.
They've been sent to Ballykinler. They don't know why they've been arrested, and they don't have a sentence they're going to serve. You can understand the real concerns they had. because they're missing work. They're losing their jobs. They're missing babies being born. They're missing mothers being sick and people dying, all while wasting away in this camp. And they do also say that they're all going a bit strange. People developing weird habits. They don't wear hats. They say headgear is despised. They don't wear collars and they don't wear cuffs. They've changed the rules of society. They get false rumours of everybody's going to be released. So there's a flurry of collecting autographs on that day and then nothing happens. So they keep track of the truce in July 1921, although they do say in the barbed wire that the truce hasn't come to Ballykinler yet, so they're still imprisoned. And then when the peace treaty negotiations begin, they're keeping an eye on those because they know if the treaty goes ahead, they might be released, but if it doesn't, they could be here forever as far as they're concerned.
With their future uncertain, the men continued to create more ways to keep their spirits up. And what better way than through music?
Hi, Christina. How are you?
Christina Bashford is a music historian at Illinois University in Chicago. And while studying the history of the violin, she came across a rare photo that was taken at Ballykinler.
So one of the things it seems that they must have smuggled in was a camera. There was a picture of the violin class with about 20 students and their teachers sitting mostly with their violins under their arms. And so Martin Walton from Dublin volunteered to run a class in violin. At that time, in 1920-21, there was a lot of emphasis put on teaching students in groups. Now, this was not so easy to do in a way because, to run a class in violin, you need violins. First of all, the British authorities were okay with it. Violins were shipped in with money that had been provided by the Irish White Cross. And he taught the class in conjunction with an Irish folk fiddler called Frank O'Higgins. And one of the prisoners, Peter Carney, very famous name, of course, in Irish history, was very keen to learn the fiddle style from O'Higgins. And I think together they have a great combination there. So, it's not surprising that Walton and Kearney would get together and write something themselves. The Ballykinler March was sometimes dubbed the Freedom March. It's a song, not a tune, the words by Kearney, the tune by Walton. It's a little march. It's got a lot of da-da-da-da-da rhythms, rotted rhythms. I don't actually know who actually harmonised it, because we know that Walton was looking for somebody to do that after publication. So while Walton might have written the tune, he didn't feel expert enough to actually make a version with piano accompaniment, but that was what ultimately was published.
Arise, as living from your century fall, arise, redeeming freedom's ray. Arise, 'tis Ireland's million soldiers call, as freemen hail the coming day.
By mid-November, treaty negotiations were ramping up, and as a gesture of goodwill, a number of internees were released. But as we hear in the newsletter, one man, Tighe Barry, while he bid his fellow comrades a safe journey home, was met with a terrible fate.
Numbered now on the roll of heaven is the white soul of Tighe the Barra. Not on the field of fight did he perish, but when his manly rejoiced at the departure from prison camp of comrades, for home from which they had been so long and unjustifiably torn, the cowardly bullet of an unassailable foeman sped to his heart core. Ma vanach tlat a Tighe the Barra, flahas de le danam.
When he was shot, someone took a little Sacred Heart badge and dipped it in his blood and then pinned it into his autograph book. Someone packed all of his belongings up and sent them off, including the autograph book, with the little bit of blood in it. It's not just a little autograph book, it's almost a relic with the blood and the Sacred Heart in it, because obviously these men have just seen a friend shot in front of them, so that's quite a traumatic experience. So they're reacting in various different ways, any way they can, just to deal with it.
On December 6th, 1921, almost a year to the day since my papa and great-grandfather were first arrested, the Anglo-Irish Treaty was finally signed.
When the treaty was actually signed, Michael Collins came back the next morning and he asked about the internees. And at first the British were not inclined to release them. But then Lloyd George and Collins agreed that this would give a huge boost to the treaty, to see thousands of guys coming home. It to almost mark as if they had won.
So on the 8th of December 1921, the men in Ballykinler are informed that they are going to be released finally. And from the 9th of December, the releases start. So they release hundreds of them at the same time. They get specially commissioned trains and they all arrive home to a hero's welcome, really. There's torchlight parades, there's crowds of thousands at the train stations waiting for them to come home. But obviously these men, all they want is to see their friends and their families again. So after a year, Peter was finally reunited with Francis. And unfortunately, we don't know anything about Peter and Francis after Ballykinler. So I presume it was a very happy reunion, but we just have to guess.
Kilmainham Jail and Frangach both have their definite place within Irish history. But where does the significance of Ballykinler lie? And what happened afterwards? Did the men just return to normal life?
Ballykinler is the one place where people from all over Ireland, not just people who become senior politicians like Sean Lamass, but ordinary, if you like, Joe Soaps, congregate together simply on the basis of their republicanism, not of where in Ireland they're from. It's almost, if you like, the last place where I think in particular people from the south would have heard of what life was like in what was to become the new Northern Ireland and of the very different kind of politics and issues there.
I mean, they had men coming out of Ballykinler with qualifications they'd never have had they not been interned, and qualifications that they were the Ballykinler certificates that were accepted in society, you know, and say mostly around 1923 when departments were set up and employment was being arranged, and men who were qualifying in engineering or whatever were accepted, their qualifications were accepted, they received employment in that discipline. So it worked, obviously they got something out of it they would never have got, and to the British, like, they actually, you know, they made a major mistake there, giving the men something they would never have had they never been interned. Obviously, Sean Lamass really kept his head down. Basically, what he put into practice as a politician, he read and learned while in Ballykinler.
If we have the wisdom to plan correctly, if we have the unity that will sink sectional aims in the national purpose, and the enthusiasm for growth and change, which is a sine qua non of progress anywhere, we cannot but succeed.
Raincoat
or anything? I have a
raincoat. Which you bring an umbrella as well. Yes, bring that with you. Take your bag.
Off you go.
Take them all up.
And you hop in there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Good morning. I'm in the carriage with your Uncle Murish and Sarika. So we're heading towards the north.
My dad, Auntie Moira, and I are on a pilgrimage of sorts.
Here we go.
Now, could you speak to this gentleman?
Hi. I'm here for Tony Conniford.
Okay, yes.
We're in Ballykinler Training Centre at the invitation of Major Tony Conniford. He's the commandant here and showed us where Camps 1 and 2 originally stood. The huts are long gone, but the archives still hold references to Ballykinler's past, including something that made an already significant journey for my family even more sentimental.
So when we sort of, I said, look, can bring the family up, let your relatives go and have a look around where the place was. We can go and actually work out where the huts were from the documentation we've got. I then did some other digging as well. And one of the documents that I've come across is a document which is, and I can't work out whether it's James or Joseph that signed this, but that's Hut 14, Camp 2, and he's quoted De Valera in a document.
Oh, that's my father's writing.
That's why I took that off you, to confirm whether it was. Okay, so there you go.
That's the same. My goodness.
I recognise my father's writing anywhere.
I only found that yesterday.
My goodness. Yes.
And I've not checked the quote, but I'm pretty certain it will be a De Valera quote, and you'll then be able to confirm whether...
Oh, yes. Oh, my goodness, yes. We have learned one lesson in Ireland, and that is that it is by acts and not by talk that a nation will achieve its freedom. President de Valera, yeah, he must go, July 20th. That's Dad's writing. Got it right. Know it anywhere?
You've never seen that before.
Never seen that before.
That's amazing, Tony. Thanks a million.
That's fantastic.
Never seen that before.
He didn't speak about it an awful lot at all. The only thing, I mean, they had one or two beatings up, but other than that, and he was so keen to learn the Irish language and unfortunately failed miserably.
He always said, "Slán, lad." And if we were sitting at the table, you know, and if you wanted the milk passed up to you, said, "Thurman banya mashtale." And he'd be delighted. He sent us to the Gaeltacht. I was sent down to the Gaeltacht at 11. But my father loved the Gaeltacht. And he was a Dublin man. And before he died, if you spoke about Connemara to him, he'd cry. He was that, he loved it that much, you know. And the thoughts that they all spoke Irish, he loved it.
So, about that donation at Kilmainham Jail.
At this stage, we're all heading to our 80s, and in my sister's case, she was 95 just the other week. So we'd like to sort of donate these to the archives, if assuming that you're interested in taking them.
We're definitely interested in taking them. We've a great collection of Ballykindler material here, and we would love to add the Heron story to that. Yeah. To see the autograph book is just fantastic.
I think it's better that you have it, that it's instead of it being lost, you know, by further generations, they might know what it was all about.
We'll make a Heron collection.
Yeah, that's nice, yeah.
James and Joseph Heron collection. Yeah.
Up like a very Republican family, you know, Republican thinking, and we were all good citizens, every one of us, you know.
But obviously it had a lifelong effect on him, because on an individual basis he was very friendly with English people, but he was very much anti-British and certainly pro-GAA and anti-foreign games.
He had a one-track mind, you know. But starts the times. Then people start to broaden their minds and say, well, they haven't got big teeth, that they did you.
Arise, these livings from your century fall. Arise, redeeming freedom's ray. Arise, 'tis Ireland's million soldiers call, as freemen hail the coming day. 'Tis Ireland's voice, 'tis Ireland's soul that calls from the sea to the sea. Our motherland, while ages roll, redeemed, erect and free.
Ballykindler, the Barbed Wire Cage was produced and narrated by Sirica Heron, supported by a grant from the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland. Sound designed by Neil Kavanagh. Actors were Sean O'Sullivan, Erin Creevan and Niamh Hassel. Arise Ballykindler March was performed by David McEntee on piano, Frank McCann on vocals and Neil Connera on violin.